listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a microbe's eye look at what makes us human.
But first, with deer bow hunting season kicking off soon, new research shows that chronic wasting disease caused a 10% population decline in white-tailed deer in a part of Wyoming, with drastically reduced survival rates in the deer population. Chronic wasting disease is caused by a prion or malformed protein in the brain, similar to mad cow disease.
We have it here in Wisconsin, too, with recent numbers showing an increase of infected deer to its highest level ever, despite less testing taking place this year. Joining us now is Michael Samuel, professor of wildlife ecology and assistant unit leader of the Wisconsin Cooperative Wildlife Research Unit of the U.S. Geological Survey. He researches chronic wasting disease. Mike, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. We've been trying to understand this disease for quite a while now.
Yeah, before we get to some of this new research, can you bring us up to date? We've been talking about this in Wisconsin for well over a decade now. How bad is it in our state now?
Well, it's not quite as bad as it is in places like Wyoming and the study you just talked about, but we're headed in that direction, and that's a big concern.
Right, things are worse in a place like Wyoming, mainly, I assume, just because they've had it there longer.
That's pretty much what we think is the case, yes. We think we've had it here for probably a couple of decades at least, but they've had it longer out there.
So this study we mentioned, it's not the first study that tries to come to grips with these numbers, but what does it tell us about the impact of chronic wasting disease on a deer population in an area?
Well, I think it sort of confirms some of the science we've been doing that says as this disease becomes more and more prevalent, it has a larger impact on the population. And as that prevalence increases to some level, it basically, enough deer die from the disease that they can't keep up and the populations begin to decline.
What is current management practice here in Wisconsin when it comes to CWD?
I would say there really isn't a current management practice per se, particularly in the south central part of the state where we've had chronic wasting disease and has continued to grow in prevalence. Pretty much the actions that have been taken are to monitor what's happening with the disease, but there really isn't any activity going on in terms of trying to control it.
Are there successful strategies that people have tried elsewhere?
That's the really tough part of this. Once the disease gets established, nobody's really been successful at sort of getting rid of it or even doing a really good job at controlling it. In areas where they've just found it, just recently, like New York, they seem to have been successful at eradicating it by being really aggressive. And I think that's a pretty good strategy if we can detect it early.
What happened in Wisconsin? Did we not detect it early enough, or were we, in hindsight, not aggressive enough in trying to keep it from spreading?
Well, I think the first answer is probably the most important one. We didn't detect it early enough. Our best science says that it was probably here for quite a while before we actually discovered it. And to be honest, it was almost an accident the way it was discovered to begin with.
How did we discover it? What was the accident that led to that?
The accident was that one of the people who was running the DNR chronic wasting disease testing program wanted to do deer testing near where she lived instead of traveling all over the state to do it. And so it was decided to be done near Mount Horeb, and that's when we discovered the disease.
Talking about chronic wasting disease among deer in Wisconsin and elsewhere, new research shows the impact the disease is having on populations when the disease really takes root. Michael Samuel is with us, professor of wildlife ecology. He's also with the U.S. Geological Survey. Mike, tell us more about the disease. What is it and how does it spread?
Well, we're still learning how it spreads, but one of the sort of the big picture is that as prevalence increases, the rate at which new susceptible deer become infected continues to increase as well. So, for example, if prevalence goes from 10% to 20%, then the probability of a susceptible deer becoming infected doubles. And so it in that sense, it becomes almost a positive feedback system. The higher prevalence gets, the more deer become infected. And that especially is the case because it takes about 2 years or so for the disease to run its full course in deer. And so more deer are becoming infected all the time. And as that continues to increase, it's going to begin to have population impacts here as well.
Now, Let's talk about consumption of deer that have the disease. How are we doing on testing deer that have been taken over the course of the deer hunt? What are the advisories for hunters who catch who take in a deer and get a test positive?
Well, the World Health Organization recommends that no one consume known meat that's been that is prion contaminated, which CWD is one of the prion diseases. So it's recommended that people don't consume it, and I think that recommendation comes because we simply don't have enough good science at this point to know what the risk is to humans. I think most people would consider the risk to be fairly low, but it's difficult to say that how low it is.
So what are our options here in Wisconsin? You said there's effectively no management strategy. I guess we're just letting this run its course. What should we be doing beyond that?
Well, so the DNR does have a testing program, of course, where hunters who want their deer tested can have it tested. So that's at least a very positive thing. Many people don't have their deer tested, and some people certainly consume the deer after they know it's been tested and positive. Management is really a tough issue. As I mentioned, as prevalence continues to increase, more deer will die from the disease. And we think that the one way to try to control it would be to try to reduce prevalence. One of the patterns that we typically see with this disease is that males have a much higher prevalence, about twice the prevalence of females. So if we can reduce prevalence in males by reducing the number of males, we might be able to help reduce prevalence in the population. The other big problem we have is that the higher prevalence gets, the more young deer become infected as well, and those are the ones that disperse across the landscape and spread the disease. So in order to do, we need to reduce prevalence to reduce that spread across the landscape. It would also help to reduce the number of deer so that we don't have so many dispersing as well.
So reducing the numbers of deer and reducing the number of males, not popular options, as I understand it, with a lot of the hunters in the state. I don't know how much you look at the politics surrounding this issue, but is that an obstacle to overcome if you want to put these into practice?
It's a huge obstacle. And until we have, you know, a silver bullet like a vaccine or something like that, there's going to be no simple solution to this disease. There's going to be pain and suffering, and people are going to be unhappy. In the long run, the disease is going to take a stronger hold, and we're going to be like Wyoming, like the study you just quoted, and our deer populations are going to decline, or we won't be able to hunt them as much as the other alternatives. So in the long run, we're going to have to pay the price here.
Now, you mentioned a possible future vaccine. As I understand it, this is a disease that's caused by a prion, a weird protein, like mad cow disease. That's not a virus where we'd usually see a vaccine created for, right? It's a different sort of disease, isn't it?
It is a different sort of disease, and that's made that idea of creating a vaccine for it very challenging. There was a recent study that was done to a trial of a vaccine that was developed in Canada, and it turned out that the vaccine actually made it eight times more likely that animals would become infected. And so we have a lot to learn about how to deal with this disease and how to develop a vaccine. And certainly there's nothing on the horizon that's going to be on the near horizon that's going to be a silver bullet here.
So you're not sounding optimistic, at least in the near term, about this disease here in Wisconsin?
I'm not, particularly if we can't figure out a way to try to reduce the spread of it and try to control prevalence.
Do you see, before we wrap up, do you see other states being more proactive, trying to do some of the things you would like Wisconsin to do?
Well, I think other states are beginning to now realize that they need to get out in front of this disease and try to do something. And so I don't think there's a consensus yet as to what to do. Illinois has tried a sharpshooting program, which they believe has been successful in some respects, but certainly the disease seems to be spreading through Illinois as well. So other than the situation in New York where they seem to have caught the disease early, no one's figured out the right strategy quite yet.
Mike, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Michael Samuel, professor of wildlife ecology and assistant unit leader of the Wisconsin Cooperative Wildlife Research Unit for the U.S. Geological Survey.
We've heard a lot about the microbiome lately, the massive collection of tiny microbes in our guts and our bodies that play a key role in our overall health and a whole lot more.
The latest research shows that microbes do much more than keeping humans healthy. They can deeply affect how we think, how we act, In fact, they play a crucial role in the behavior of pretty much every animal on Earth.
With us now is Ed Yong, science writer at The Atlantic and the author of I Contain Multitudes, The Microbes Within Us and a Grander View of Life. He writes the blog Not Exactly Rocket Science on National Geographic magazine. Ed, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, first of all, what is a microbe?
A microbe is an organism that's just too small to see with the naked eye. So the vast majority of what we're talking about are bacteria, but there are a few other kinds as well. And they exist in the world around us and in our own bodies in extreme numbers, tens of trillions of them, roughly one for each of our own human cells.
And it seems like for a long time, microbes got a bad rap. They were germs. They caused disease. They were the thing you wanted to wipe out of your body. But now it seems as though the tide is turning, and we're starting to embrace microbes and really start to crack the code on what they're capable of doing. What's changed?
I think a couple of things. Technology has changed, so we're getting a much better understanding of the sheer diversity of the microscopic life that shares our bodies and what that life is capable of, how they help to digest our food, how they train our immune system, how they protect us from disease, how they build our organs. And I think also there's a cultural shift. As you say, for the longest time, these things have been neglected and feared, and by scientists as well. Most of the work on microbiology was on finding new ways of killing and eliminating microbes. But more and more scientists who work on beneficial microbes have shown that these things are important, and they're starting to work together. So just as microbes work together with us to shape our lives, so the scientists who study microbes are starting to cooperate to find all sorts of incredible new discoveries.
Well, tell us about one or two of the big discoveries that we've been seeing about what microbes are capable of.
So we know, for example, that rather than destroying our bodies, microbes actually help to build them. If you look at animals from mice to fish to flies that lack microbes that are raised in sterile conditions, you see that all parts of their bodies fail to develop properly, their bones, blood vessels, guts, brains. So much of this process of development depends on signals from the microbes that we carry. And we know that microbes even help to build the immune system, which is amazing because we think of the immune system as something that protects us from microbes. And yet we see that microbes not only it construct parts of the immune system, but help to calibrate it so that it can react to infections and keep us healthy, while also not overreacting to harmless things in the world around us like dust or pollen or bits in our food.
And it sounds like there's some pretty amazing emerging science about the role microbes play in our mental health.
Yeah, a lot of this comes from animal studies, and we see that depending on whether mice and rats have microbes or not, and then depending on which microbes they carry, you see changes in their behavior, in their ability to cope with stress, in how vulnerable they are to anxiety, in bits of their mood and personality. So it's very clear that microbes, even those in the gut, can affect the way we think and the way we behave. And what that means for human health and behavior is still unclear. A lot of this work has been done in animals, and not a huge amount has been done in people yet. But it seems entirely plausible that our microbes could also be affecting the way we think.
Now, what your book does is it flips around this equation and looks at the world from the microbes' perspective. So what does life look like when it's seen from the perspective of the microbe, this tiny, tiniest of organisms on Earth?
From the point of view of these little things, our body, even a single individual's body, can be this vast landscape consisting of different habitats. So the gut is an environment rich in food. It's dark, it's moist, it's a bit like a rainforest, whereas something like the skin on my arm is dry and parched like a desert. And all different parts of my body, of our bodies, vary a lot in the microbes that live with them because of these physical traits that make them as different as grasslands or coral reefs.
And you've actually, I mean, it's possible to see them, and you've seen them and described them. Can you do that for us?
Yeah, you can see them down the microscope, and they look like everything from spheres to corkscrews to long ovals, and they move. It is very obvious that they have animacy, that they are alive. And all the things that we think of as relationships between the animals that we can see are found in the microbial world, too. There are predatory microbes that eat prey. There is competition, cooperation. There are groups that feed each other, that poison each other with toxic antibiotics. So there is this rich life, and it all occurs in the confines of our bodies. And microbes can also do a thing that we humans find very difficult to appreciate. They can swap their genes. So even though you and I might only be able to pass our genes down to our children, two bacteria can trade DNA just as easily as you and I trade conversation. And that allows them to evolve at incredible speed. And they do so even more so in our own bodies. That trade of genetic material is ratcheted up a notch within the confines of the human body.
Wow. Well, speaking of genetics, how has our advancing of genetic science changed what we know about microbes?
It's allowed us to really understand how many there are out there. So it used to be that microbiologists had to grow these things in a laboratory or you look at them under a microscope. But like something like 99% of the microbial world is either impossible or very difficult to grow in a lab. And it was only by looking for their genes that we really understood who was out there. And now there are vast chunks of the tree of life that we only know about because we've managed to sequence microbial DNA, that we understand who is where based on the genes that they carry.
We're talking with Ed Yong right now, science writer at The Atlantic, and the author of the new book, I Contain Multitudes, The Microbes Within Us and a Grander View of Life. And looking out to the future now, a future with lots and lots of microbes, what do we know about how we might harness the capabilities of microbes to do things like fight disease?
So one of my favorite stories here involves a microbe called Wolbachia. It's a type of bacterium that lives in the cells of insects, and it's very, very common. It's in something like 40% of insect species. One of the insects it's not in is Aedes aegypti, the tiger mosquito, the one that spreads things like Zika and dengue fever. And for many decades, scientists have been trying to get Wolbachia into the tiger mosquito because for some reason it stops the mosquito from spreading the viruses behind these diseases. And because Wolbachia is very good at spreading through wild populations, if you release small numbers of these infected mosquitoes, they ought to be able to seed their uninfected peers with this bacterium very, very quickly. And then you get mosquitoes that, instead of spreading disease, are actually dead ends. And this approach has been tried in Australia and in many other tropical countries. And I think it has tremendous potential for beating Zika, dengue, a lot of these other tropical diseases that cause so much suffering and death.
And it sounds like we also, I mean, that would be amazing within the Zika angle, but another aspect of public health, which is of great concern for a long time, is cancer. And it sounds like we might be able to tweak our response to maybe our immune system, the way we respond to drugs based on microbes.
Absolutely. On the one hand, it seems like the microbiome may be involved in the development of some types of cancer, like colorectal cancer. It's not the case that any specific bacterium or microbe is responsible, but maybe a change in the community to a negative state can further the development of some types of cancer. We're still looking into that. But there are also cases where many cancer drugs, including some of the latest blockbuster immunotherapies that work by stimulating the immune system, many of these seem to work better in some people than in others, depending on the microbes they carry. So in the short term, maybe you'd be able to look and work out whether some person should get drug A or drug B, depending on which microbes they carry inside them. And maybe in the future, we might even be able to tweak those microbes to give people microbes that make cancer drugs more effective in their bodies.
Well, we're starting, as you said, we're starting to appreciate maybe the potential of microbes and how they can aid us in our efforts to be healthy people. And, you know, to that end, there's tons of probiotics on the market. People are interested in fermented foods and yogurt. What do we know about what we should be doing to have a sort of good microbe hygiene?
Well, we know that certain things in our diet can make a difference. So, for example, eating lots of fiber helps to nourish a wide range of microbes within our gut because fiber consists of all these complex carbohydrates, and no single species of bacterium has the full cutlery set it needs to digest all of these. So if you eat a wide range of plants, a lot of fiber, you nourish this wide community of microbes. They, in turn, produce chemicals that are good for the gut, that help to reduce inflammation, and that have many benefits. Beyond that, going more specifically, it's hard to give any particular advice because we're so early in this stage of science. And that's especially clear when we look at products like probiotics, which are meant to contain beneficial microbes, but that actually rarely live up to the hype that surrounds them. Even though they are very good for things like infectious diarrhea, they don't seem to do a huge amount of good, or at least a consistent amount of good, against a lot of other conditions that have been linked to the microbiome. And that's probably because they contain the wrong species of microbes in very small concentrations and a lot of very domesticated strains that aren't very good at colonizing the body. So in the future, almost certainly we will develop formulations of beneficial microbes that will affect our health in positive ways, but we're not quite there yet.
And just super briefly as we wrap up, do you feel differently about your own body knowing there are these hordes of microbes living on it and in it?
Yeah, I actually am quite in awe. The first person to see microbes with his own eyes, Anthony van Leeuwenhoek, was actually astonished and delighted to learn that he was home to so many microbes. And I am too. I think we feared them for a long time, but I want to appreciate them.
Ed, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That was Ed Yong, science writer at The Atlantic, author of I Contain Multitudes.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up tonight at 7, it's the Moth Radio Hour. Tonight, 4 stories of lessons learned, lessons of sharing, flirting, parenting, and more. That's coming up after 7 on the Ideas Network.
First, a massive trove of documents was leaked from the John Doe investigation into Governor Walker's recall campaign and published yesterday by the Guardian newspaper. The documents reveal that Governor Walker was actively involved in raising money for the Wisconsin Club for Growth, a super PAC that provided support to Walker and other Republicans in recall elections.
The documents also include information about donations from a lead paint manufacturer and laws passed in the Republican-led legislature to shield makers of lead paint from liability.
In an interview today, Governor Walker declined to confirm whether he's still raising money for the Wisconsin Club for Growth or other third-party groups.
With us now is WPR's Capital Bureau Chief Sean Johnson. Sean, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
So, Sean, I know you were taking a little bit of time to look through some of the documents available, and what have been the big narratives, the big stories to emerge from this leak?
I mean, from a Wisconsin perspective, where we've been in touch with this investigation for a while now, and this some of this stuff has made news for a while now. The big takeaways for me was just the volume of information out there and really kind of the surgical precision with which The Guardian approached this story. I mean, they highlighted all these portions in the documents that were relevant to the story, and you did get this larger picture of Governor Walker being a very active fundraiser on behalf of the Wisconsin Club for Growth. That's significant because while candidates for state office have to report their donations and face contribution limits, donors to groups like the Wisconsin Club for Growth can give unlimited amounts of money and they can keep their donations secret. And so the governor was actually referring to the Club for Growth in one email as our C4. It's a reference to our 501 C4, which is basically saying that the club is his in so many words. So there's a pretty strong link there between the governor and the Wisconsin Club for Growth that plays out throughout all these documents.
And based on what we knew of John Doe 1 and 2 over the years, which was limited until now, is that a surprise, seeing that close proximity?
We knew that, I mean, we knew there was a connection. It was no secret that Governor Walker's, one of his own campaign advisors, a longtime campaign advisor, R.J. Johnson, was working simultaneously for the Wisconsin Club for Growth. So the link was pretty obvious. I think the degree to which Governor Walker was personally soliciting funds for the Club for Growth is illustrated more in these documents here. I mean, we should mention that one thing we do know, because this has already run its way up to the state Supreme Court, is that what he's doing in these emails under Wisconsin State Supreme Court's interpretation of Wisconsin campaign finance law is legal. Under the law of the land right now in Wisconsin, what the governor is doing here, soliciting donations from billionaires, you know, like John Menard's, talking to John Menard, saying, "I got $1 million from John Menard today." Menard's then cutting a $1 million check to the Club for Growth. Under the state Supreme Court's reading of campaign finance law, that's not prohibited, but it definitely raises eyebrows because it's the kind of thing you don't read about.
And that's a law that was changed just last year during the John Doe investigation. That wasn't the case, correct?
So what the court said is that essentially this, the court's read was that that's always been the case. But once they ruled that, and that that was the law in Wisconsin, then the legislature and Governor Walker followed it up and essentially codified that ruling and you know, made that the law of the land in Wisconsin, not only through that Supreme Court ruling, but in the statute books.
You mentioned the name Menard, and I guess that seems like another surprise in these documents, is that for the first time we're having access to the list of these donors that we hadn't before, because the Wisconsin Club for Growth was allowed to leave the donors anonymous. So who are some of the big names on this list?
I mean, John Menard is one of the ones that jumps out to us in Wisconsin, not only because we know the Menard's chain, but you know, the size of the donation there and kind of the nonchalant way in which the governor refers to that donation. The Guardian chose to highlight donations to Donald Trump, or from Donald Trump, excuse me, after the governor met with Donald Trump. One of the other donations that made news in Wisconsin that we haven't heard about before was donation from an executive who ran a company that once manufactured the lead used in lead paint. And there were a total of $750,000 worth of donations made to the Wisconsin Club for Growth over a couple years in 2011, 2012. During that time, you had Walker signing a pretty sweeping, you know, tort reform law that shielded companies that once made lead paint from lawsuits, made it very difficult to sue them. And then in 2013, the legislature took another step. They inserted a few lines in the state budget without much fanfare, and that's essentially made it hard to sue lead paint companies retroactively. That is, even if some of these kids who filed lawsuits for lead poisoning and filed it before the law had changed, were already in the court system, this law would have applied to their cases retroactively.
And we should point out that the prosecutors in this case have appealed it. It's before the Supreme Court, and we'll be hearing whether or not the U.S. Supreme Court will take this up. When might we hear, and how likely do you think that is?
Yeah, I would yield to your next guess on that. I mean, as far as when the U.S. Supreme Court acts, it's sort of a mystery to those of us who don't watch it on a daily basis. I mean, this is a case that we're keenly interested in here in Wisconsin, but it's one that's been going along. From a Wisconsin perspective, this has been going on for a while. I mean, John Doe has its roots kind of in John Doe 2 has its roots in John Doe 1, which began, you know, before Governor Walker even took office. These cases have been out there for a while, and so that seems to be the final resolution. It is now before the U.S. Supreme Court.
And Sean, before we let you go, what has Governor Walker said about this?
Governor Walker had an event today in Edgerton, and he called the leaks old news, said they were an attempt by people who had lost in court to win in the court of a public opinion. And he mentioned that he had been, you know, this investigation had been essentially cleared by the U.S. Supreme Court. They ended John Doe, which is true. I mean, that is absolutely true. The court said there was nothing, no wrongdoing here, and that this type of coordination is legal. At the same time, the governor really didn't want to talk much about the coordination that happened, and at his stop in Edgerton when he was asked whether he still raises money for the Club for Growth the way that he did in these emails, he didn't answer. He did say later at another stop today that he's not raising money for them right now, but it's not something that he ruled out doing in the future.
And I think the Wisconsin Supreme Court, you said U.S. Supreme Court there. But
yeah. Okay. So, I mean, the Wisconsin Supreme Court has ruled on it. The U.S. Supreme Court, we're still waiting.
And developing story. Sean, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
That was WPR Capital Bureau Chief Sean Johnson. And Richard Hassan joins us now with more on the leaked documents. He's professor of law and political science at the University of California, Irvine, and the author of the book, The Voting Wars. Richard, thanks a lot for joining us.
It's a pleasure.
So what do you make of this, the takeaway of all of these documents and seeing the vast amounts of money involved? What do they tell you?
Well, I think what this shows us is that all of the suspicions people had about what was going on behind the scenes were actually borne out, that this was really a fully coordinated effort involving the Republican governor, involving his staffers, involving state legislative staff and Republican-oriented lobbyists in an effort to win a series of elections, including a state Supreme Court election and various recall elections. And in exchange for some of this money, these business groups and wealthy individuals were getting access. They were getting legislation passed that benefited their financial interests, and they were, because they were using this C4 organization, they were assured of anonymity from the public. Sure, the Scott Walker could know and feel very appreciative of this, but the public did not get the benefit of knowing who was donating money that was being involved in these various election campaigns.
And a lot of these donors, they're not anonymous anymore, thanks to this leaked trove of documents. How do you think that anonymity, when it comes to the large amounts of money that we're talking about here, how does that affect the political process?
Well, one of the reasons that people like me favor disclosure is that it lets voters have a sense of who is trying to influence elected officials. So if, for example, it was public that people with an interest in the lead paint litigation, which involves, you know, many people, children who suffered from lead poisoning and other maladies from lead paint, if the public knew that $750,000 was in this campaign or in these campaigns backing these Republican legislators, and in exchange or even just afterwards, we see all kinds of legislation being passed that helps these interests, well, then the public would have been able to use that to be able to judge whether or not these elected officials should remain in office. Without that information, it's very hard to know and really hard to follow the kind of stories when there's all of this going on behind the scenes.
We had the author of the original reporting from The Guardian join us on the program yesterday, Ed Pilkington, and he said in a section of his piece about why it matters, the concern was whether these large corporate donations had the potential to distort the democratic process, and that was a big question for him. Would you agree with that?
Well, I do think whether the money is disclosed or not, large amounts of money can distort the political process. That is, you and I may have very intense interest in public policy and what the state legislature should do or what Congress should do, but when someone has $1 million, they're going to have at least a chance to make their case. So even putting aside bribery and any improper action, it just means that the wealthiest among us have much greater ability to have influence over who's elected and what policies they pursue. And those concerns are just exacerbated when the information about the money being given is fully known to the politicians, but not at all known to the public.
We're talking right now with Richard Hassan, professor of law and political science at the University of California, Irvine School of Law. And we're looking at the leaked John Doe investigation documents, which were published yesterday by The Guardian newspaper.
And we'd like to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What do you make of what you've seen of all these documents? What does it say about politics and government here in Wisconsin? Do you see these kind of donations that are now being released as affecting the state of our democracy? What do you think about the leak itself? Possible investigation into who leaked it in the works? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're continuing our conversation about the documents published yesterday by The Guardian newspaper, revealing information gathered in a John Doe investigation from here in Wisconsin during the recall elections.
We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Have you read these new John Doe documents or about them? What does it say about how we do elections here, about election laws? Do you worry about the impact of corporate donations and how laws are made? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Post on the Central Time Facebook page or tweet us at Central Time WPR.
Richard Hassan stays with us. He's professor of law and political science at the University of California, Irvine School of Law. And Richard, we were mentioning earlier that this is a case before the U.S. Supreme Court. We'll find out whether or not they decide to pick it up and run with it. So wondering your take on this. Do you think that's a likely scenario?
Well, it's never likely just looking at the law of numbers. There are thousands of petitions filed, and the court only hears about 80 or fewer cases a year, and they're even probably going to hear less now that they're shorthanded with a 4-4 liberal-conservative split. But I should point out that there are really two issues before the Supreme Court, and the court could choose to hear just one of them. And I think that is a fairly likely possibility if the court decides to hear the case. So one issue is the issue you've been talking about, which is whether or not the First Amendment prevents regulating cooperation between candidates and these non-disclosing groups that are engaged in election-related activities but that don't expressly advocate, say, vote for or vote against. So that's one issue, and that issue is somewhat mooted by the legislation you referred to, where the Wisconsin legislature has kind of changed the rule to make what the Wisconsin Supreme Court said was required, constitutionally required, part of the law. But the other issue, the one you haven't mentioned yet, has to do with the judges who sat on the state Supreme Court and who decided the case, including Judge David Prosser, who was recently retired from the court. He was, as is clear from the documents that were posted by The Guardian, a great beneficiary of the spending. The Republicans who were circulating these documents were very interested in maintaining a Republican majority on the state Supreme Court. And because of that, because he was this great beneficiary of the spending, Prosser and other justices were asked to step aside to recuse themselves. They refused to do so, and the argument is that that is a due process violation, that you can't have someone with such a personal interest in the case being someone who's deciding the case. And that issue could possibly interest five justices on the Supreme Court to hear the case.
Prosser has said he didn't recuse himself, Justice Prosser, because enough time had elapsed where he felt the conflict of interest was not as acute as it may have been if there was one earlier. Is that likely, as the Supreme Court looks at that, to be something that would make them less likely to take it up based on his argument?
Well, Prosser has said that in some interviews. Prosser himself didn't file a brief in the case. He's now retired from the court. I don't find that argument very credible. Certainly, it could have been a great source of embarrassment for him had all of this information come out about all of this fundraising going on to his benefit. And the fact that it was a few years later, at a point where we didn't know if he was going to retire or not, indicates that he would still have a personal interest in how the case was decided. And the Supreme Court has said, as a matter of due process, you cannot have a judge deciding a case who has a personal interest in the outcome of the case. This wasn't just a theoretical question. He was directly implicated in these documents as a great beneficiary of the spending. And so I think if the Supreme Court decides to take the case, again, that's a long shot for any case, it's more likely to do so on the question of the fairness of the the panel of judges that heard the case rather than on the campaign finance issue itself.
Let's take a caller now. We've got Chris joining us in Milwaukee. Chris, hi.
Hi. My question is, to me it seems like it's corrupt government and it's pay to play, but I'm just wondering for people who are either entrenched Republicans or entrenched Democrats, if they hear this, is it even going to make a difference as to your opinion as to how they would vote? Would it affect their vote?
Chris, thanks a lot for that. And Chris is getting at sort of the ennui and disenchantment surrounding politics right now. Congress with a record low approval rating, people not very big on Congress or politicians in general. So is this going to make a difference, Richard?
Well, it's hard for me to say, but one thing that's pretty clear from my watching Wisconsin politics from afar for these, say, the last 6-7 years is that your state is one of the most polarized in the country. And people are, I think, quite divided between Democrats and Republicans. One of the things you haven't mentioned that I think is one of the biggest bombshells from the release of the John Doe papers was in relation to the David Prosser, Justice Prosser reelection campaign, where it was very close and going to go to a recount. You had Republican operatives exchanging messages saying that they should basically gin up talk of Democrats engaged in widespread voter fraud in order to undermine the case that Democrats might make that there should be a recount, or that Joanne Kloppenburg, who was at one point narrowly ahead of Prosser, should be declared the winner. And so it really shows a kind of cynical manipulation of the process. And looking at that as Wisconsin voters, I think a lot of Wisconsin voters are not going to be happy when they see the politicization of the counting of the votes in your state.
I'm going to take another call here. We've got John on the line in Iron River. John, hi.
Hello.
What did you want to share?
Well, all the corruption that runs around, and we dance around the words, but it's out-and-out bribery. That's all that it is. I don't see how that's going to end.
John, thank you for the call. And there is whether or not these things will be seen as running afoul of the law in Wisconsin. So far, the answer to that is no. And there's also the appearance of how these things look to people. How do you kind of split the two, Rick?
Well, in terms of bribery, nothing in here indicated a kind of quid pro quo. If you give me $750,000, I will pass this piece of legislation. But that's, you know, so that kind of conduct, that kind of smoking gun did not appear, at least from what I've seen, of these documents. But that doesn't mean that other laws were not broken, and it could well be that had you had a fair panel of the Wisconsin Supreme Court that was not did not include judges who were personally involved in the case, they might have indeed concluded that this was illegal coordination, that is, violation of campaign finance laws, even if it was not a actual kind of bribery.
Thank you for that call. And another quick call from John in Madison. John, hello.
Hello, this is John.
Yeah, what did you want to share, John?
Yeah, I think maybe your guest answered it for me, because with the current campaign finance laws being changed, if in fact the governor had broken campaign finance laws, say in 2012, he still can be held accountable for what took place in 2012. That's what I'm trying to verify. That always seems to be skipped over.
Got it, John. Thank you. And Rick, your answer briefly.
Well, it's certainly possible that the Supreme Court could take the case and say, you've misunderstood the First Amendment, and so it is legal to ban this kind of coordination, and then they would send the case back to the Wisconsin Supreme Court to look at again. It's not clear what would happen in that circumstance.
And we leave it there. Rick, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
That was Richard Hassan, professor of law and political science at the University of California Irvine School of Law. And he joined us to talk about the new leaked documents in Wisconsin's John Doe investigation.